This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November 22nd, 2021, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Today we have part two of our interview with Indianapolis restaurateur Martha Hoover, the founder and owner of the nationally lauded Patachou family of eateries. We know them as Cafe Patachou, Petite Chou, Napolese Pizzeria, Public Greens, Apocalypse Burger, and Bar 114. In part one last week, we focused on how Patachou Incorporated responded to the pandemic by reducing expenses, streamlining operations, building resiliency into the organization, as well as applying for and receiving millions of dollars in federal aid. We talked about the closure of the Napolese Pizzeria downtown and whether downtown is still a viable market for restaurants. We delved into her plans to expand the chain with two new Cafe Patachous in central Indiana, as well as a presence in a neighboring state. And I also asked about how long she plans to continue operating the whole enterprise. It was a full slate, so please check it out if you haven't already. Our first conversation hinted at several problems inherent in the restaurant industry, as well as a wide-scale misunderstanding of how restaurants operate. So we decided to come back this week with another conversation that takes a wider-angle view of the industry. Hoover believes the traditional restaurant business model is broken, and it took the pandemic to reveal its weaknesses. The industry is built in part on risky templates for compensating employees and determining menu prices. Hoover says Patachou's food is priced to accurately reflect the investment necessary to maintain quality, compensate employees fairly, and reduce risk in a notoriously finicky industry. We also discuss what the food media doesn't understand about the restaurant business and the simplistic way it portrays the industry. There's a lot to talk about. So here's part two of our conversation. I'd like to welcome back to the podcast for the second time this month, Martha Hoover. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. A great friend of mine, he used to work for the IBJ, Anthony Shutley. I don't know if you ever worked with him. Had a great thing that he did at the end of all of his interviews. I mean, almost without fail. He would say, before signing off, is there anything that I haven't covered that you think is important? And we had really, such a wide-ranging conversation last week. There's so many topics, that you wanted to cover that we just didn't have time for. I thought I would come back and ask you, what do you want to talk about? And I think you've got some pretty serious concerns about the restaurant industry, for example, that you would like to speak about.
Concerns maybe gives the wrong perspective. I love the restaurant industry. I am completely, completely in awe of it and its impact on so many lives. But coming out of COVID, what happened as we entered COVID is it became shockingly apparent to me that the restaurant industry was poorly understood by most people, including people who are in the restaurant industry. Everyone knows that restaurants are risky businesses, but I don't think they know why they're risky. And they assume that it's risk because if the food's no good, people will disappear. And that's the risk. But there is so much more at stake on a daily basis every time a restaurant operator opens up their doors to start the business day, that are completely separate from the plate, which I think is something that we could probably talk about for hours.
Hours. We don't have hours. One of the things that I think you mentioned briefly in the last interview is that, well, not necessarily talking about your family of restaurants, the industry is in a way inherently broken. And I wanted to know more about that. What are you referring to exactly?
Well, the model, the business model is broken. So what has happened over the last, let's say, 30 years that I started my restaurant? I didn't know in 1989 when I opened my first restaurant, I had no idea how broken the industry was. The reason I didn't know it is because I'd never worked in a restaurant before opening my own restaurant. So I did not know what was wrong with the industry, and I also did not duplicate any of those issues in my own company. I wouldn't have had I had the choice, because they were incredibly, we didn't use the word toxic back then, but they were incredibly toxic practices. So we have a history of an industry born out of a time when the people who worked in the industry were the most marginalized people, and there was very little respect for the food or the fruits of their labor. And, you know, when you start an industry based on not caring about the people who make the industry possible, only caring about the consumer that also makes the industry possible, it becomes a very unfair dynamic. And so what we have today, we have remnants of an industry that has a cross-section with our cultural view about food. And the cultural view about food is, particularly as it relates to restaurants, is the value statement that customers want and have been told is fine, and they should prioritize. Those priorities are convenience, quantity, and price. So when you have that as your value paradigm, you don't have a system that allows to do better for the people who work in it. If you're only talking about ways to attract people to a restaurant in terms of consumers based on the most amount of food for the cheapest amount of money and the most convenient, you have uncheckered growth, you ignore things like quality of product, quality of place, you treat your people as if they're disposable, and that's what's happened in the industry. COVID did not kill the restaurant industry, did not kill the independent restaurant industry, but it did show the industry where the problems were, where the fault lines were, and what needs to be corrected. So coming out of COVID, the whole promise was one of hope, where restaurants would see all these problems and that they would come out and establish these new normals and make these changes. And unfortunately, most restaurants and most restaurateurs have been unable or unwilling to do that. Mm. They've gone back to normal. And that normal, to me, was like a pretty low bar. And most of the problem, I think, is that most restaurants follow a template, and the template is broken.
What specifically elements of the template are broken? And it sounded like you were headed towards talking about how they treat employees.
Well,
and not necessarily like being mean to them, you know, in the kitchen, but also, I mean, the kinds of wages that they earn, the kinds of benefits
pandemic
that they get.
Yeah,
has been that a lot of people who worked in the restaurant industry decided that it wasn't worth it. At least that's the narrative.
I understand the restaurant world is based on minimum wage jobs.
A lot of people who work in the restaurant industry
decided, very little opportunity for most people to have a way up and a way out. So you have minimum wage, that is, you have menu pricing that is constrained by what consumers will and will not allow. You have extreme competition for these employees, but employees who are not given opportunities in other industries. So the restaurant owner, manager, the restaurant business for years has been able to take advantage of people. I mean, the bottom line is, I'm a capitalist. I'm in business to make money. My businesses need to be profitable so that they can continue and be sustainable, be resilient, not be vulnerable. But let's face it, most restaurants, the way restaurant business right now is defined, is most restaurants are not terribly profitable. And you know, someone mentioned this to me 25 years ago. They said there was a lot of glitter, but not a lot of gold in the restaurant world. And it's the glitter that people chase and not the gold. And, you know, that's a really crummy way to be in business, to know that the significant number of restaurants in the United States make a profit of between 3% and 5%. Yeah, you have outliers who are making 15%, 20%. You have publicly traded companies, venture funds, equity people that are funding restaurants that where the return is greater. But at no point in time is that return greater because restaurants are using higher quality food and paying people properly. There's been this proliferation of restaurants because in order to make that glitter, to turn that glitter into gold, you have to have a lot of them. So it feeds itself. Probably not for the same reason why, let's say, healthcare workers are leaving or airline employees are leaving their industry, tech people are leaving their industry. It shows you, that since tech people get paid way more than restaurant people, that probably the money isn't what is the only thing that's driving people in or out of industries. There are more stressors. And the restaurant industry, I think for most people not in the industry, I don't think there is an understanding of how difficult it is on people's mental health, the stress that restaurant workers are under on a daily basis, let alone in a pandemic. You know, that, and that features in. I think if you dive into the statistics why healthcare workers are abandoning their jobs, the reason that they really give is the stress of the job as opposed to the greater purpose of the job or what they're able to make financially, how they support their families. Just the stress is too much for people.
Yeah, traumatic stress.
It's horrible. But here's the thing that healthcare workers and restaurant workers have in common. Unlike tech workers, and even unlike banking people, right? I'm just thinking of industries. Healthcare workers and restaurant workers cannot call it in from home. We cannot Zoom in to a restaurant and do our jobs. So part of the stress was that if you were working in a restaurant, and that was your source of income, you had to show up. You had to be there. And at a time in COVID when no one, especially the first 8 months pre-vaccination, no one really knew what was going on. And the stress of working in an unknown environment is remarkable.
Lesson was the industry supposed to learn that you think is now forgetting?
I think the industry should have learned this is the major nut that needed to be cracked. You cannot have an industry based on the cheapest pricing, because what happens when you have an industry based on cheapest pricing is you cannot pay your staff properly, and the owners of the businesses do not make the money to cover their risk. So you have vulnerabilities within the system, and you just don't have vulnerabilities regarding the worker. You have vulnerabilities regarding the business owners as well. And that's a legitimate something to be worried about. You know, everyone like talks about celebrity chefs, David Chang and everybody else. And I've met these guys a million times. They have no idea who I am. And here's how I've always looked at their ability to monetize their positions as chefs. If their restaurants were, and David Chang's the first to say this, if his restaurants were making the level of income that people think his restaurants are making, he would not have to do a deal with Nike. So there are, you know, costs to all of, to every aspect of the restaurant industry has a ripple effect cost that goes, that wherever the stone stops, right, the ripple goes out, wherever that stops, it's because our food is too cheap, and it's so cheap that you can't pay its people appropriately, which means that you don't honor the people appropriately, the people responsible for the food, and you make a situation where the owner has too much at risk and is not making enough, there's not enough reward for most owners. So what happens when you have a cataclysmic event, or even an event that's not cataclysmic, but is still significant, a closure of 3 days because of a, God forbid, a restaurant fire or whatever it is. What happens to the restaurant itself? You know, it's a lot. But here's what I think we have to realize is there is literally a formula that restaurants use to ensure profitability. And that formula says that labor cost and food cost should not exceed 60% of total operation costs. Okay? So usually, you know this from covering old school restaurant business model says you have overhead at 30%, labor at 30%, food at 30%. And if you're lucky and all those percentages are precisely where they need to be, that leaves 10% for the owner, operator, company that's managing. So here's the thing that I always think about. People act like, and I'm just going to throw Jimmy John's out here, that, or Subway's, or McDonald's. People talk about the value of that food, and they act like they're getting a deal because my sandwich costs double what a McDonald's sandwich costs. You're not getting double the value. And that's what you are getting is a sandwich that, even at McDonald's, 30% of that cost goes to ingredients, 30% of that cost goes to the employee. Now, when you break it down like that, a $6 sandwich, what does that leave? Think about it. What does that leave in terms of a $6 sandwich? That means what percent, what dollar amount is actually for the ingredients? And even more disturbing, what dollar amount is for the employee?
Would they say in response to that, but we make it up in volume?
Well, you know what? Here's the thing. I Googled in preparation for this. I wanted to make sure my data points were right. So I Googled 10 different resources of profitability of restaurants in the United States. Everything from the National Restaurant Association statistics site to Bureau of Labor Statistics and everything in between. The average restaurant makes 3-4%. So here's what they tell you if you look at all these sites. You want to increase profitability, you do it two ways traditionally. You decrease your food cost and you decrease or control your labor cost. The third way that they talk about increasing profitability is you increase your volume. Now, increasing volume requires something outside of your ecosystem usually, you know? So you cannot say, even a restaurant that would say, if only we could increase our volume by 20%, then the restaurant would be able to pay people more. Well, how do you increase your restaurant overnight by 20%? The vast majority of restaurants, including McDonald's, do it by offering value meals and creating opportunities to increase cash flow. But cash flow and profitability are two different things. So yes, volume is a huge issue. And that's why restaurants proliferate. You can't just make it on one restaurant usually.
Okay, let's take a quick break to digest this information and hear from our sponsor, Taft. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast and our conversation with Pataschew founder, Martha Hoover. So Pataschew was built on values that included really not compromising on ingredients.
Yeah.
Fresh, local, seasonal ingredients.
Right.
So that's in stone. My understanding is you also like to you compensate fairly your employees. And that
That's true.
You're the expert. I mean, you have benefits that maybe some other restaurant chains do not have.
Yeah.
So where do you have to adjust to make things work, to make the business model work?
I made the business model work because I entered the marketplace saying, I'm not giving away my product. I'm charging. My menu prices reflect my company's needs and values. Now, here's the bottom line. People love to talk about Potashoe values. Every company has values. Even the convenience store run by the local BP gas company, BP Petroleum, has values, right? Just my values are not those values.
Right.
And our values do distinguish us, and they have since 1989, and they are etched in stone. So you asked, how was I able to do it? I did it mostly because I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to do it this way. I did it by saying, you know what? That chicken salad sandwich, that costs a lot. There are a lot of people who touch this literally and figuratively before it gets to a plate. We did at the beginning of COVID a poster that we put out on social media of how many people it takes to make a single chicken salad sandwich. Now, I know people at home are kind of rolling their eyes going, how many people? It takes one person, it takes the chicken salad, takes the bread, whatever. No, go back, starting with my chicken farmer that I've had relationships with for 25 years. Talk about the people that chicken farmer employs, how that chicken gets processed, gets shipped to me, what happens when the chicken gets shipped. I can go through the whole poster. I think my whole point is, it's such a complicated system of delivery of product. And what I tell my staff is, even a chicken salad sandwich represents so much more than a chicken salad sandwich. A chicken salad sandwich, in my world, represents the 300 people who work for the cafe. It represents the needs of the business to be able to pay these people fairly, to be able to enrich their lives by creating opportunities for them, by being able to do things for the community, by it enables us to keep up with our premises. It enables the company to grow its brand, which ultimately hires other people. I mean, this is kind of what a small giant does. You don't grow for the sake of growing. You grow for a very specific reason.
So let me rub it back to the beginning of the conversation. We're talking about things that people don't really get about how the restaurant industry works.
Yeah.
So when they go to Potashoe and they say their signature omelet is $15.
Mm-hmm.
Last week I was at Denny's and their signature omelet was $10. And they think, oh, Martha is making a mint.
Yeah.
They charge me $15 for an omelet. And then your response is, I am accurately reflecting what the real cost of this is.
Thank you. I could not have said it better. And by the way, I'm not only accurately reflecting the real cost, I'm also reflecting the needs of my business to stay stable, to be able to grow, to be able to do what it does best. You have to understand what the value of that Denny's omelet at $10. And that's the disparity. That's what people don't understand initially. They're like, precisely what you said, that $10 omelet at Denny's versus a $15 omelet at Potashoe. Well, let's talk about what the difference is in that omelet. Quality of ingredients, without a doubt. Quality of ingredients. I mean, we're in the food business and we hold ourselves out to be a higher quality restaurant. We put a tremendous amount of resourcing into our resourcing. So the quality alone. Also, our premises are much different. Our give back to local community is much different. The way we treat our employees is significantly different. So for that $5 delta, that $5 isn't going into Martha Hoover's pocket. I wish it was. That $5 is supporting an incredibly complex ecosystem where people are given opportunities for, to you know, that whole thing about a boat a lifting tide rises all boats. I really believe that. I think that we're at the beginning of a cultural moment where people are like, you know, Denny's has a purpose. I'm not suggesting that Denny's should fold. You mentioned Denny's, not me. But I think the greater opportunity is for people to go, ah, light bulb moment. There are secret hidden costs to running businesses the way the current restaurant business model is run. And that cost is you're not going to get high quality ingredients, and you're not going to be able to pay your people appropriately, and the owners themselves will have vulnerable lives. You know, my goal is to not have to close restaurants. My goal is to keep people employed and for the business to be stable, not just stable, to be profitable and to be able to do good things in a variety of ways. That's my line and I'm sticking to it, Mason.
Can you shed, just because I'm not an expert in this and I haven't worked for you, a little bit more about how you compensate employees and offer opportunity in a way that other chains would not, in a way that is more expensive?
Yeah, well, no one in our company makes less than livable wage. Vast majority of people make more than livable wage.
How are you defining a livable wage for your employees?
Well, we define it as in Marion County as $15 or above an hour.
So everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Does that include the servers?
Well, servers are, you know, that's a really great point. Servers make, in our system, make well above $15 an hour. They are tipped employees. They do not make $15, and I want to correct that. They are not paid $15 plus tips, but their average tips bring them north of $40 an hour.
Yeah. So effectively,
you know, that's the thing that when people talk about the restaurant industry and they talk about going tip free and who's tipped and who isn't, you know, what we're really seeing and what I think people are becoming aware of is this disparity, not just between front of house and back of house, not just between servers and non-servers, but also amongst restaurant genres, right? So there are 50 million different kinds of restaurants, and they all have different economic systems that they're dealing with. But the bottom line is they all should be profitable, right? And they should be profitable without exploiting their labor or exploiting their community.
I wanted to talk a bit about your view of food media and what we get wrong. Or what we misconstrue, what we focus on that is unimportant, or the things that we should focus on that we don't. I mean, I'm sure that you have a lot of feelings about how we represent restaurants.
Food media is, I mean, that's just a huge business now, right? And the problem with food media is, I think what you alluded to, everyone is supposed to be an expert in a restaurant industry, on the restaurant industry, but really, food media most of the time talks about the same two or three people and shows the same two or three variations of a plate of food that all looks very Instagrammable. So you don't get the nuances. I don't think people are doing, and I applaud you for doing this right now, saying, you know, I'm expected to be an expert on the restaurant industry, but I've never owned or operated a restaurant. Maybe you worked in a restaurant when you were in high school. I don't know.
Three restaurants, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's really funny. Yesterday, I got an email from a mother saying, someone I don't know, but I'm very easy to get a hold of, so people email me directly. And the email was, my 15-year-old son wants a job. That's code for, I want my 15-year-old son to have a job. And are you hiring? Are you hiring? He would even be a dishwasher. And I was like, oh my gosh, you have so pushed my buttons. Mom, first off, if your child, 15-year-old or whatever, wants a job, tell your 15-year-old, who I'm sure knows how to use a computer, to go on our website and fill out the application, number one. Number two, even a dishwasher. That to me says so much about the public's view. Our dishwashers know more about waste than any accountant. Our dishwashers are logistical geniuses. And it's not just our dishwashers, it's dishwashers in general in the restaurant world. You want to know if the soup's good, ask the dishwasher. Not necessarily because the dishwasher has refined palate and tastes the soup and can tell the chefs what they did right or wrong, but the dishwasher will know if the soups are, if those soup bowls are coming back clean or not. So the idea that a dishwasher is not a professional position, it is not so that it is something that even a 15-year-old who doesn't really want a job but whose mom wants the 15-year-old to find a job, that that's something a 15-year-old can do. And that just sums it all up to me. We don't have the proper respect that we need for the people who are making, delivering, whatever, that plate of food. We just don't. You had asked earlier what we do for our employees, because yes, we pay employees. Yes, we offer a pretty robust benefit package. It's not the benefits that matter to the benefits like health insurance and 401ks are phenomenal benefits. But the true benefit, I believe, of working in a company like Potashoe is what we offer to enrich people's lives as opposed to just engage them at work. And I think that is another point of distinction. We decided 5, 6, 7 years ago that our values would be best served, our company would be best served, if we really enriched our employees' lives, as opposed to just telling them what they were supposed to do and paying them whatever we paid them. And that enriching of lives includes continued opportunities for education, continued job training, continued mentoring, educational opportunities. We have something I think I mentioned last week called PotaU, Potashoe University. On Monday night, I had the humbling experience of speaking to the Potashoe graduating class, the Potashoe U graduating class. There were 18 members of the class, only 3 of whom were in our existing management pipeline. People that were in the class all volunteered to be in the class. They were not getting paid to do this. This was on their personal time. It's a program that we sponsor, the company pays for, but people join it because they want to improve their lives. They want to become basically better at all aspects of their lives, not just better at how they can work at the company, but just better all around humans. We had 18 people who all spoke about the transformative effect that this Potashoe University has had on their lives. That to me is a benefit that goes so beyond just putting money in your pocketbook. Because what it does is it gives people the soft skills they need to succeed, whether it's in a professional world or a personal environment. And to me, that is a real honor to be able to lift people up like that.
How long have you been offering that program?
That group was our first cohort. We just started it. The idea has been percolating for 3 years. COVID-19-20 got in the way, as did part of 2021. But coming out of COVID, we knew that we had to do better. We knew that we needed to be not just more efficiently run, that we needed to really understand whatever waste we had and put a hard stop to it, not create waste at all. But that we really, you know, we've got these incredible 300 people in the company. We don't hire slugs. It takes a lot to get hired at the company. You go through a lot, lots of interviews, lots of people that you meet with. The onboarding process is, you know, it's a work in and of itself. We do it intentionally because we don't want a revolving door. We want people who understand that Martha Book of Rules is going to be their code of conduct in our four walls. But guess what happens? Martha Book of Rules becomes people code of conduct outside of our four walls. all of this does go to our sustainability and resiliency work that we do, saying that this is what the company will look like in 10 years. This is where, these are the changes, this is the goal, this is what we want the company to look like in 10 years. How do we go from starting point today to 10 years? What changes do we need to make? And one of the changes is we need to do more for our employees. And that's what we're doing.
My thanks again to Martha Hoover. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest issue of IBJ I want to bring to your attention before you get too wrapped up in the holiday. First up, in a city filled with developers who can handle complex, multi-use projects, the businessman who came to Lafayette Square's rescue is a relatively unknown 50-year-old from Argentina named Fabio de la Cruz. Mickey Shuey has a proper introduction and dives into his $200 million plan to transform the retail center into a cultural hub featuring a concert center, movie theater, hotel, apartments, and a shopping village. Also in this week's paper, Emily Ketterer explains how the federal $1.2 trillion infrastructure package will help Indiana. And John Russell has the Feds' latest report card on how well Indy area hospitals are keeping patients from needing to return to hospitals after their initial treatment. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business, community, and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Certainly, there's somebody on your Christmas list who would enjoy this. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.